But what I want to do this morning is explore the claim that we've made this whole time, that you always do what you want to do. Because that throws some people for a loop. I can think of several times in my life I didn't do what I wanted to do. There's things that I do almost every day that I don't want to do. Go to work, or I like work, just for the record. But I'm just saying, people say that all the time. Like, I don't want to get out of bed right now and go make breakfast. I don't want to, but you do it. And so how do we wrestle with the claim I'm making, and I think the Bible makes, that you always do what you want to do, and yet every day we experience things that we don't want to do, especially when we sin as a Christian. We go, I didn't want to do that, but I did it. So to start off with, I want to share an example. It is in the book, but I did some research on it because the book, he just referenced it, and I was going, you can't leave me hanging like that. Anyway, whatever. So I go look this story up, and I don't remember it. It was 2003, so I would have been, it was fall of 2003, so I would have been a junior in high school. I know I'm old, but anyway. So there's this pizza delivery man who robbed a bank and had a bomb around his neck. Do y'all remember this story? You do, okay. So I look it up, and years later, they started finding out more of what the real story was. So here, let me just show you how knowing certain details changes your view of what decision this guy made, okay? And the point in this is to show you how even we know that motivation has a lot to do with freedom of a choice. Again, we've been advocating this whole time. Your freedom is not found in your ability to do anything. Your freedom is found in that what you do, you did because you wanted to do it. So just to give you this example to show you an illustration of this. So this man walks into a bank, slips the teller a sheet of paper that says, give me $250,000 in cash within 15 minutes or I'll blow this place up. And he had a bomb around his neck. So what is your immediate impression of this guy? He's crazy. What a filthy human being. Like, this is a sorry excuse for someone who's an image bearer of God. I mean, all these thoughts go through your head. Well, then the detail that I left out is he's a pizza delivery guy. He got called to deliver a pizza. Two people held him down, strapped the bomb to his neck, and sent him into the bank for them. So then you go, oh, okay, well, now I didn't realize that detail. So that kind of changes my view of why he chose what he did. Now, I hope this isn't self-righteousness speaking. I still don't give the guy an excuse. I mean, if someone said, I'll blow you up if you don't shoot your kid, blow me up. Like, so it still doesn't get him off the hook, right? I mean, I feel bad for the guy. But if you put a bomb around my neck and say, go rob a bank or we'll blow you up, blow me up. I'm not robbing a bank. Like, it's, he still had some freedom, right? Why did he choose freely? Now, it's a limited freedom, but why did he freely choose to go rob the bank? Yeah, because the alternative was not appealing to him, right? Yeah, I love my life. Hang on to that. I'm glad you said that. So again, we view it that way. Now, your view of him changes again when you realize he was in on the plan. It was his plan with these two other people. So one of the two guys, and this is, I'm trying to get the story straight because obviously they couldn't interview the guy with the bomb around his neck. Just spoiler alert, they blew him up. But he was asked by one of those two guys to kill that guy's dad. So apparently one of the two people had a father who had a large inheritance he was going to give the son. So they wanted the dad dead. Well, the guy said, I'll kill him for $150,000. Well, they said, well, let's come up with a plan to rob a bank for $250,000. I mean, you can see how wise this group of three. And so anyway, your mind changes again on this guy knowing that, okay, they put the bomb on him and sent him in, but he was in on the plan. Now I'm back to going, what is wrong with this guy? Well, then it changes again because the plan was to use a fake bomb. And he gets there and they pull a gun out on him and they switch it with a real bomb. And so you can just see how every little detail changes your view and how guilty you feel like he is. And there may be some guilt, but it's less than if... You see what I'm getting at here. His motivation, why he's doing what he's doing, changes the way you view his decision. Again, even with a bomb around his neck, he still is making a free choice to go in and do what they say. You can just not do what they say. A lot of times you watch a hostage movie or something like that, it just no, I'm not going to do it. Like, oh, I'm going to kill you. Well, you're going to kill me anyway. Like, just kill me now. Anyway, I argue with TV a lot. Anyway, the point is this. Think through why someone does what they do, and you realize that's where their freedom is found. That's where their culpability is found. Now, I'm not saying you can do a wrong thing for a right reason and you're free. You know, as an example I've used before is there are people whose thinking is darkened, right? Unbelievers thinking, their minds, Ephesians 4, are hardened. And there are mothers who abort their babies, murder their children because they think it's good for their family, okay? So I do think there are people who are deceived and have an abortion because they actually think it's a good idea. Now, they're dead wrong, but I don't look at that situation and go, oh, well, then they're not guilty. No, they are guilty. I don't care why you did it. You murdered someone. But what we're trying to look at this morning is looking at how and why we make certain decisions. And the claim that I'm trying to make, I think the Bible puts forward, is that you always do what you want to do. And that's what I want to look at. And so this idea of being guilty and culpable, think, if you will, Ephesians 10, right? Do not forsake the what? Ephesians 10, 25. I mean, Hebrews, sorry. Hebrews 10, 25. Do not forsake the assembling what? Together of yourselves, right? So Christians get together, okay? Are there sinful reasons people don't get together with other Christians? Absolutely. Happens all the time, right? Are there legitimate reasons people don't get together with other Christians? Like if I have a surgery on Friday and I'm in the hospital on Sunday morning, do you go, hey, other three pastors, we need to talk to Josh. He's not in church this morning. It's like, no, you understand why I'm doing what I'm doing. So again, all that, let's take that into consideration. Let's look at this. On your sheet, I have the if you walk away with one thing, walk away with this phrase, okay? We are free because we always do what we most want to do at the moment of doing. If you walk away with one thing, walk away with that phrase. We are free because we always do what we most want to do at the moment of doing. The idea with this, again, is you always do what you want to do. And you go, well, that's not true. I can tell you 10 things last week I didn't want to do. Well, at the moment of decision, you wanted to do it or else you wouldn't have done it. And I want to show you some of this. We are free, and we've said this all semester, we are free because we are acting in a voluntary way. We got to remember how we define freedom here. Your freedom's not found in what you could do. Your freedom's found in why you did what you did, your willingness to do what you did. On your sheet, I've got a quote there from Jonathan Edwards. A lot of these are from the book. I think they all are, but Edwards' book on freedom of the will is helpful as well. But he says, Jonathan Edwards, a man never, in any instance, wills anything contrary to his desires or desires anything contrary to his will. I mean, think of what Edwards just said there. A man never, in any instance, wills anything contrary to his desires or desires anything contrary to his will. He's saying in a very convoluted way, you do what you want to do. That's exactly what you do every time. This leads me to the conclusion that it would be more helpful for us to speak of freedom of people, not freedom of the will. I mean, it's just, you're free as a person to do what you want to do. When we get into the whole will aspect, it gets a little more confusing. But on your sheet, do you have extras, Paul? I forgot to grab one for myself so I can know which quotes are on yours and which ones aren't. Yeah, so you've got a second quote there by Scott Christensen. This is from the book directly. He says this, the source of choosing lies in the heart's affections and deliberations by which motives emerge to generate the willing of a choice. Now, you can chew on that for the rest of the day. He's basically saying, again, you do what you want to do. You can always look at what you did, and there was some reason at that moment of choosing that was why you wanted to do it. And that's what he's getting at. We never act against what we most want to do. Now, again, you may be like an onion and have layers. They may have various desires that you have, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But at the moment of choice, the one you most wanted to do at that moment won every time. So different factors can influence what we want to do, if you will. Everything you'll see comes from what we want to do. Nothing is more basic than the idea of what we talked about earlier. I said, remember that answer, and it's self-love. Now, I got to be honest here. I'm fully convinced of what we call biblical counseling, and I love like ACBC, CCEF, those kind of organizations. One of the things that we say often, and there's a reason we say it this way, and it's biblical, is the Bible never commands you to love yourself, ever. And one of the reasons we say that is because our culture is so driven to you, right? You go to a psychologist, they say, what do you want out of this meeting? What would you like to change in your life? I mean, you are the sun. Everything revolves around you, right? And so we're trying to counter that with the Bible going, no, actually, there's never a command in the Bible to love yourself, ever. The assumption is you love yourself, because Jesus said, love your neighbor as what? You love yourself. He didn't say, hey, love yourself, then love your neighbor. It's, listen, you already do a pretty good job of loving yourself. Just love them like you love yourself. What can happen, though, is we start to look down on this idea of self-preservation, self-love, and think that it's always got to be sinful. But I would imagine everyone in this room does everything they do, and I'm convinced of this, for self-preservation, self-love. It doesn't have to be sinful. It's sinful when you use self-love in a sinful way. And we'll talk about that in a second as well. But again, your sheet, I just looked here. Everything you do is rooted in those two blanks there, self-love. You've got to get a grasp on this. At no point in your life do you not love yourself. I don't care what you do. Suicide, drugs, play the lottery, take care of your kids, serve one another. It doesn't matter what you do. It involves you loving yourself. And that's the reason that we don't have to tell people to do it. They do it naturally. It doesn't have to be sinful, though. It most of the time is, because we are by nature sinful. But look at what this quote is from Blaise Pascal. He says, all men seek what? Happiness. Well, who are you trying to make happy? You, right? This is without exception. Whatever different means they employ, they all tend to this end. The will never takes the least step but to this object. This is the motive of every action of every man, even those who hang themselves. And I'm not trying to make light of suicide, but even in suicide, they do that because they think that's the best choice at the moment, right? This is the easiest way for me to escape this problem, or this is the best way for me to deal with this issue, or I can't take it anymore. I've got to do that. I mean, you see how, again, I'm not saying that's the only motivation, but it does involve that. The greatest thing anyone's ever done and the worst thing anyone's ever done at all, from the greatest to the least, involves self-interest. Self-interest is the base motive of every action, even as it's conjoined with other motives that taint or make it a virtue. You can do something for yourself and it not be sinful. And I want to talk about that here in a second, but everyone has self-love. Look at Matthew 7. This is what we were just referencing, but I want to show you the verses. Again, you look at your concordance, you thumb through your Bible, do your yearly Bible reading, and circle every verse that commands you to love yourself, and you're not going to find it. But that doesn't mean the Bible then means hate yourself. Self-denial and hating yourself are not the same thing. And I want to mention that when we read the verse. But look here at Matthew 7. Look at verse 12. So whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them. For this is the law of the prophets. Why is it good for me to treat others like I would want to be treated? Yeah, I don't want people to mistreat me. I don't mind mistreating people, but I don't want them to mistreat me, right? I don't mind gossiping, but when they can do it about me, it's a problem. I don't mind lying, but when they lie to me, it's a problem. Notice that. And so Jesus is assuming this already. Hey, the way that you want people to treat you, treat them that way. That is the idea here. Look at Matthew 22. This is even embedded in the two greatest commandments. Matthew 22. Look at verse 37. Jesus asked, verse 36, someone asked him, teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? Verse 37, and he said to them, Jesus said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Again, the implication is, you know how good of a job you do taking care of yourself? Like, you don't mind tying your shoes? go tie your kids' shoes. Like, you don't mind putting food on your plate, put food on their plate. Like, you don't mind taking care of yourself, take care of others. The idea here, again, is we do this naturally. This is even true in marriage. Look at Ephesians 5. Look at Ephesians 5. A good marriage hinges on your ability to love yourself. And that sounds really weird because we're always talking about we got to love the other. And I'm not saying we don't. I'm saying notice what Paul even recognized here in Ephesians 5. Look at verse 28. In the same way, husbands should what? Love their wives as their own bodies. What's the standard for the way you should love your spouse? How do you love yourself? He says, in the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. Is it good for you to be good to your spouse? Yeah, so even in me being good to my spouse is some self-interest here. I want a better marriage. Like, I don't think that's a bad thing to want, right? And so I know the better I am to them, the better this is going to work out. Now, I also want to be good to them because I love them. This is not the only reason, but I want you to see it involved. Verse 29, for no one ever, what? Think of that blanket statement there. No one ever hated his own flesh. Again, this is the opposite of what we're saying. Everyone does what they do because they want to do it for themselves. No one's ever done anything without interest in self. He says, but nourishes and cherishes it just as Christ does the church. The idea here is Paul's saying, a marriage here implies the idea of you take care of the other like you take care of yourself. Husbands, love your wives like you love your own body. Philippians 2, verse 4. This context of humility, the idea of unity. Philippians 2, verse 4. Let each of you look not only to what? His own interest. It's like, wait, he doesn't say you're not going to look to your own interest. You can't do anything without doing that. He's saying don't look to yours only. Look not only to his own interest, but also to the what? Interest of others. Again, the idea is self-love here is implied. It's not the psychological idea of self-love that you just need to look at yourself in the mirror like, is it? I can't remember the guy's name, but he'd look in the mirror, oh, you're so great, you're this and that. And that's not the idea of self-love that he's getting at here. The idea that I'm getting at, and the idea I think is implied in the Bible, is we preserve ourselves. And every decision you'll ever make, you're making a decision for what you feel like is the best decision, and you're making a decision for what you feel like is best for you. Now, that's not your only motivation. You can genuinely do things because you love other people, but even in that, you know that's good for you. If you're a Christian and you're convinced you should serve other people, you're convinced you should serve other people, and you're also convinced that's good for you. Does that make sense? That's the holy side of it. The unholy side is, I don't care what you want, I'm going to do what I want. That's where I abuse this idea of self-interest. This is not something you get rid of as a Christian. It's something that's sanctified, and you actually do it for the first time. Think, if you will, an unbeliever, if this is true, everything an unbeliever does, they do because they think it's good for them. When you become a Christian, it's the first time you've ever been right about that. I mean, think of every step towards holiness actually is good for you. Every step towards unholiness or wickedness is not good for you, but every unbeliever is convinced it is. I will be happier if I take this guy's wife. I will be happier if I drink this till I can't remember anything. I'll be happier if I lie and cheat on this test. Everyone's doing what they think is best. It's just they're always wrong about what's best for themselves. So they don't love themselves. They don't love God. They don't love their neighbor. They're strike out on all three. As a Christian, I can do all three. By loving God, by loving my neighbor, I can also do what's best for myself. Again, as a non-Christian, you have been wrong about this idea of promoting yourself your whole life. As a Christian, it's even easy to get back into that way of thinking, to selfishly promote myself over God and others. You finally see that loving God and loving others is in your best interest as a Christian. It's not in my best interest to promote myself over you. Not just because we won't have unity, but I'll receive judgment for that. I don't want judgment. That's an idea of self-preservation. There are certain things you do because you know the difficulties that come not doing them. That's self-preservation. And it's okay. That's good. They're there for a reason in the Bible. Holiness is good for you. And so to say that you want to be holy in order, because you want to be holier, because I want myself to be holier, is not bad. In order to do something that makes you holy and happy, it's okay to say you want to be happy. You have never been better to yourself than when you've been holy. Think about that for a second. The best thing possible for you is that you would function like you were created to function, and that is in whose image? Right. So the holiest you've ever been or ever will be is the best you've ever been to yourself. Anything short of that, you're not actually doing what you think you're doing. Again, you have never been better to yourself than when you've been holy. Here's the rub, though. This is where it was a little uncomfortable for me, because didn't Jesus teach, turn to Luke, let's see, on your sheet, 14. Luke 14, didn't Jesus teach we should deny ourselves? So it gets a little awkward, like, wait, this dude from Georgia is telling me I should love myself, but Jesus said I shouldn't. I wonder who I should listen to. Listen, if me and Jesus ever disagree, please go with him every time. But look at Luke 14. Even before we read this, think of 1 Corinthians 13. Love does not insist on its what? Do you know what it says? Love does not insist on its own way. It's like, well, that doesn't sound like what you're saying at all. I mean, love seems to love others, not themselves. Again, look at Luke 14. Let's look at what he says, if I can find it. Verse 25, start there. Now great crowds accompanied him, and he turned to them and said, if anyone comes to me and does not, what? Hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life or his own soul, he cannot be my disciple. So did Jesus require hatred of father, mother, wife, daughter, whatever you want to throw in there, and even self in order to be his disciple? So let's, just before we get there, it is what he says, but let's ask, okay, what does he mean? Because doesn't the Bible also command us to love and honor our father and mother? And here Jesus is saying, hate your father and mother? Okay, right. So when it comes down to it, if there's a choice to make, remember that Y diagram months ago? And you've got to choose father or Jesus, mother or Jesus, go with Jesus. If you choose your interest, yourself, or Jesus, go deny yourself. But that doesn't mean everything you ever do will be that choice. Does that make sense? For instance, I'm not disobeying my parents today or dishonoring them by preaching. Does that make sense? I can both do something they enjoy and do something God enjoys at the same time. Now, an example of this that would go the other way is I told this, I cannot remember where I was. I guess it was Friday morning Bible study with the boys. There was a girl in California in our college ministry, not in the one I was over, but in the larger group. There was 600 of us that got together or whatever. And she was raised Buddhist, and she became a Christian, wanted to get baptized. And her dad told her, if you get baptized, you're completely cut off from this family. This girl's in college. What's she going to do? So she's got a choice to make. And this is where this verse becomes applicable. You know what? I can choose to love my father and mother, or I can choose to love Jesus. In this action, I can't do both. Jesus better win every time, or else you can't be his disciple. You can't choose to put someone over Jesus and then claim to be his disciple. That's the point here. Even if that someone's yourself, that's his point. His point is not that you should therefore hate yourself, just like his point isn't you should hate your parents. It's if need be, and there's a decision to make, there's a fork in the road, you better go this way, not that way. Again, this is very clearly seen with all the commands in the Bible. What's the first commandment with a promise? What is it? I left my supersonic ears at home. Okay, so that's the first and greatest, but what's the first commandment with a promise? Honor your father and mother, right? It'll go well with you in the land. They won't kill you. But love them. That's the idea. Honor them. Mark 8 helps clarify this. Look at Mark 8. Again, Jesus' point is not go hate yourself. Every day your goal ought to be as miserable as possible. That's not his point. You're not a greater disciple because you make yourself miserable. You're a greater disciple, and you're actually a disciple, when you choose Jesus over yourself if the need be. When you choose Jesus over father, mother, friend, brother, sister, whatever the connection is. Jesus over job, whatever happens. 8:34, look at what he says. And calling the crowd to himself with his disciples, he said to them, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life would lose it." Just real quick, notice the self-interest even implied after this statement of denying yourself. Look what Jesus said. "Whoever would save his life would lose it, but whoever would lose his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul?" No one wants to get on Judgment Day and go, "I worked my whole life to have no profit on this day. This is what I came here for." No, we all want that day to go well. And that's good. You should want that day to go well. But recognize that involves self-interest. This is what I'm getting at this whole time. Jesus says here, do you want to save your life? Yeah, we'll lose it. Do you want to lose your life? Yeah, we'll save it during this one. You'll lose it. I mean, you again, even in these commands, the idea is everyone wants their life to go well. Everyone wants what's best for their life. It's just as sinners, we don't understand what it is. Look at this quote from Augustine. This will help show the dichotomy or the issue that Jesus is getting at here. Augustine says, "If you love your soul," you could say life or your soul, "there is danger of its being destroyed." Think about that. People who love themselves in a sinful way where they are the, like I said earlier, they're the sun. The whole world revolves around them, me, 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 right? Call them me monsters if you've seen some things on that. The idea here is if you do that, you will be destroyed in the end day. Look what Augustine says. "Therefore, you may or must not love it, since you do not want it to be destroyed. But in not wanting it to be destroyed," what? You love it. I mean, think of that. Denying yourself in order to follow Jesus is the best thing for you. And so it gets a little matrixy, but in denying myself, I'm loving myself the best. Do you get what I'm trying to drive at here? Jesus is calling people to abandon all desolate and worthless pleasures of this earthly life. The call here to hate what will never bring you what you're looking for. What's found in Christ is worth whatever the cost, even if it's your own life. That's the idea we see in the apostles. I mean, Paul laid his life down because it was worth it. Wait, how on earth is giving up your life worth it? Because of what I'll gain. Every time we sin, you are doing the trifecta. You are hating God, you are hating others, and you are hating yourself. You are not doing good for anyone when you sin. When you pursue holiness and you are obedient, you're doing good for everyone. You are loving God, you're loving others, and you're loving yourself. That's the best thing for you, others, and God. Across the board, every time you sin or pursue righteousness, it affects all three of those. The reason that I feel odd saying this and the reason we feel odd hearing this is because we all know that self-love is a very dangerous two-edged sword, right? I mean, this is easy to slip away really quickly and just, let me just live my life how I want to. Well, you will, but where are you getting your information for what's best about your life? Where do we normally get our information for what's best for us? Just as humans, I'm not talking about Christians or whatever, just where do people get the information, this will be good for you? Okay, say that again. Okay, culture, media, right? Here's the political view you ought to have. I would imagine the news station you watch influences that a whole lot, right? Instant gratification is a reason that drives a lot of people. Culture, oh, well, so-and-so is popular. I want to be popular, so I'll do so-and-so. That must be good for me. I mean, you just think of where all those pieces of information comes from. That's why their idea of self-love is so convoluted and way off. And it's always sinful. But, you know, Timothy, I can't remember the exact verse, but Paul tells Timothy that in times, one of the terrible things that will happen is people will be lovers of self. He has in mind there the sinful way of doing that, which is usually what we see. In our depravity, it's used to promote evil desires and corresponds to greed, covetousness, envy, jealousy, and the like. And you can read it another time. I just saw it here. 2 Timothy 3:2 is where he says that. But as a new creation in Christ, someone who has a new nature, God's wisdom regarding self-love is restoring me to something that's in concert with loving God and loving others. I mean, think about it. If someone cuts me off in traffic and my impulse is to do what? Okay, yell at them. That's the PG here, right? You yell at them. I know that's not good to do, because why? What are some reasons it's not good to do? Okay, so it's not loving my kids. They'll pick up on that. What else? Okay, so it's not good for me because it'll cause me to be more ingrained in sinful behavior. It's also not good for me because God said don't do it. I'm not loving him in doing it, and I know I'm going to face judgment day one day. It's not good for my interest to do what he says not to do. I mean, you see how in that action, someone cuts me off, I explode. I can tend to want to bring that in because, oh no, that's not how I love God, others, and that's not good for myself either. Again, those aren't at war with each other. They are at war with each other if you're not convinced holiness and happiness are the same thing. Again, this is, we're born with sinful natures. We're conceived, if you will, with sinful natures. But when born again, human beings do what God says is good, right, and true. Then and only then do we truly act in the best interest of God, others, and ourselves. All sin and temptation is rooted in deception. The idea here even goes back to the garden. We can know what people wanted to do most by looking at what? What they did. I can know what you wanted. I can know, no matter how many millions of desires were in your heart this morning, I can know you most at the moment of choosing wanted to come to church here. Why can I know that? Because you're here. Now, that doesn't make it righteous. You could want to come here, and we'll talk about this in a minute, because the alternative was just that terrible, right? You'll be grounded for a month. Or whatever. You get the idea. This is how it worked in Genesis 3, right? What did God say to do with the tree and the fruit of the tree? What did he say to do? He said, don't eat it. What did the serpent come along and say? Yeah, he didn't say that. God said, you'll die. What did the serpent do? Yeah, surely you won't die. You know? I mean, notice the deception in that. That Eve saw the tree was what? Good for eating, and then she goes after it. Eve made a decision there. It's one that's rooted in deception. We learned that in 2 Corinthians 4. But it's still a decision that she thought was better for her than what God said. Does that make sense? This is what we're driving at here. They believe that eating and bringing would bring enlightenment. It did enlighten, if you will, but not the way we needed it. They were convinced that they knew what they needed better than God. That's every unbeliever's problem. They are convinced that their way of pursuing happiness is better than God's way of commanding happiness. And that's the ultimate road. This is how temptation works. You're choosing what you're convinced is best at that moment. Again, we always choose what we want, even if that want destroys us. Think about the person who commits suicide. They're still choosing what they want, even though it costs them their own life. Because at that moment, they're that convinced that's the right answer. So how does this work? How do we handle this this information we're talking about here? What we want to, let's see. I don't have the answer for that blank there. We all know that self-love, oh yeah, two-edged sword. Sorry, it just popped in my head there, on your blank there. We all know that love is a two-edged sword. It's just a warning there. Be careful. I'm not saying this as to, well, then just go through life doing whatever you want all the time, because you are wrong about what you need to do a lot, right? And I say you, y'all, us, we. Next on your blank there, what we want to do always is in accord with our desires. And that's what I want to end with here is, how do we, at the moment of decision, how does this look with desires? Because as I said earlier, there's a lot of people who wake up every morning going, I don't want to get out of bed, right? So is that a real desire for anyone in this room? Is there ever a morning where you go, I don't want to get out of bed? I see a couple honest souls whose reward is great that is telling the truth. Some of y'all are lying. Maybe you're just way more righteous than me, but there are a lot of mornings I go, man alive. Like the snooze button gets an exercise, right? But what gets me out of bed? Or what gets you? Yeah, so you got something to do. No one can't fix their own breakfast, right? That'll be nice one day, but it's not now. It wouldn't be a good one. It'd be goldfish or something, because they can grab that bag. And there's other desires that come along and defeat that desire that That doesn't mean I get out of bed and all of a sudden I'm just super pumped about getting out of bed. It's, no, I got to do these other things. They win. Does that make sense? So that's the... Exactly right. Or you're staying in for self-preservation. Again, it's rooted in every decision we make. You're convincing yourself over and over again that you're doing what's best and what's best for yourself. Edwards said this. He said, the will is always determined by the strongest motive. Again, it's just what we're driving at this whole time. Some of you may have your doubts about this. Again, I think a couple of illustrations will be helpful. We all look back on our life and see a whole mess of things we wish we hadn't done. So how do we explain this? And the idea is this, and the book points out this idea of conflicting and competing desires. Conflicting desires, it's this idea that, let's see, a conflicting desire would be, we've used this before, but I'm walking down the street, a mugger comes up to me, says, give me your money or I'll shoot you in the stomach. Do I want either one of those? I don't want either one of those, right? But there's one I really don't want. I really don't want the other one, but I really, really don't want the other one. So I will gladly do what I don't want to do because I don't want the alternative. Does that make sense? So even in that moment, I'm willingly handing him my wallet. Now, my willingness is a little constrained here because you've only limited my options. I mean, I could run, right? Put my family in danger, and so I don't want them to get hurt. So probably the best thing we can do here is, here's my wallet. I don't know. I mean, yeah, so that whole policy of lesser of two evils comes up in this. So you can see how conflicting desires can play out there. But that's not, we usually don't run into muggers who demand our money. It's not usually where we live. So let's think about something else. Cereal, all right? Something as simple as this. You wake up, you go, well, now I've got two competing desires. Don't want Captain Crunch or Golden Grahams. It's like, my decision's probably going to be swayed by which one's opened, by which one's closer, right? If the boys are eating one and I don't mind eating it, I probably like this one better, but this one's closer. I don't have to get up from the table. There's a whole lot of reasons I may choose between those, but those are two good things that I both desire, but in the end, the one I most desire is going to win out. That doesn't mean I therefore hate Captain Crunch. Does that make sense? It's, well, they were already eating Golden Grahams. If my, as I said, my two sons are playing with each other for a championship in sports, well, I want both of them to win, but they can't, right? Let's say that my Haddon's pitching and Owen's hitting. Oh, boy. Like, there's going to be some motivation that rises to the top. Let's say that, you've got two sons and one of them, this is his last year in the league. This is the other one's first year. Which one do you think you'll cheer for? The one who's about to be done. It's like, oh, well, that doesn't mean I hate my other son now. It's just, yeah, I do want him to win because this is his last year. Like, it's, you can see how two good desires can compete with each other, but still, you're going to do the one that you want to do. There's also times where we pick against two negatives. You're stranded on a desert island, and your only food is moldy bread or rotten tomatoes or rotten fish. It's like, well, oh, man. Like, I'm stuck with these two choices. Something's going to win out. I eat that rotten fish, it's going to kill me, so I might as well die not eating it. These tomatoes are going to be terrible. They're going to make me puke all day. You know, it's just like, okay, this is nothing but negative choices here. I'm going to choose which one I want out of this. Again, the idea is no matter what options you're faced with, you're going to do what you want to do. That's our idea of freedom. All of this to say that even when our choices in life appear random, know this, they never are. You always do what you did for a reason, even if you didn't think about it in a way that you remember. For instance, where you're sitting right now, there's a reason you sat where you sat. Now, I don't think you walked in and made a pros and cons list and said, okay, Monty's over here, but he's over here. If I sit here, I can get the donuts. Like, it's just, usually you just come in and sit down, right? Like, that's usually the way it works. The idea, again, is, but you still sat there for a reason. You may not have went through a whole process of, listen, wait, before we sit down, we got to pray about this. Like, you probably don't do that, but you still think about it. There's a reason you did. You didn't think about it, but there's a reason you're facing me and not facing the back wall. There's a reason you're not sitting on the sidewalk outside. Now, you didn't think this morning, I shouldn't sit on the sidewalk outside during Sunday school. There's a reason you're not doing it. The idea, again, is you're doing what you're doing for a reason and intentionally. We're always satisfying the desire that wins at that moment. This is helpful to understand because it explains reasons for everything you do. Even when you find yourself doing something you swore you would never do. Again, imagine, if you will, that there's I'll say Haddon again, he's 16 years old, and he hates cutting grass. Let's just say he hates it, right? And I say, look, you need to go cut the grass. What do you think his first response is? Yeah. It's, oh, man. All right. What did we hear last night? The Bible doesn't say how old the devil was when he rebelled, but I'd imagine it was a teenager. the idea is, like, his first response is going to be like, oh. But then I come in, I go, hey, I need you to cut the grass. And if you do, we'll go to Walmart and buy a brand new video game system. How does he cut grass now? I love cutting grass, right? And so in that moment, something he hates in a normal situation became something he loves. Like, does it look good? I can go over it again. We'll go over it. I'll do cross cutting. It'll look great. You know, he gets excited about it. And the idea, again, is you can make someone do something they hate if the other option is that motivating. A son willingly cutting grass, even with scissors, if you will, because his dad promised to give him a new video game system. Or let's use a negative motivator. He hates cutting grass, and I go, if you don't cut grass, you're grounded for 6 months. Well, what's worse, grounded for 6 months or cutting grass? Well, you'll know which one's worse by what he does, right? If he goes, don't care, I can now know he hates cutting grass more than he hates being grounded for 6 months. But if he jumps up and goes, oh, sounds great, I can know he hates being grounded for 6 months more than he hates cutting grass. Again, an undesirable activity can beat out a less desirable outcome at times. Notice again that the boy, in this instance, Haddon, is always doing what he wants to do. Even though removed from that situation, he would never say, I want to do that. Let's say you go to another country and there's a food you never want to eat, but the couple that's hosting you feeds you, serves it. What do you do? Now, there are some people who wouldn't eat it, but most of us would eat it, right? Like, I never want to eat that again. But I'm at that Italian lady's house and, you know, you eat it. That's the idea is we all, that's the way that one person came to me, and this is a legitimate question, and said, how can you say we always do what we want to do if I regret any decision ever? What would you say is the answer to that? In that moment, you didn't regret it, right? Think about this as a Christian now. This is where it gets sobering. As a Christian, every sin you've ever committed, why did you commit it? Because you wanted to. And as a Christian, when you are, you know, you feel the weight of that sin, no matter what it is, you repent, you don't want to do it again, you've got to admit to yourself, I wanted to do that in that moment, and that's what upsets me so bad. Like, I actually, when that person cut me off and I yelled, what bothers me is, absolutely, I violated what God said, but what is odd about this is I find myself still wanting to sin. Like, even as a Christian, you can, this is helpful in those decisions. Start working through, tracing out why you do what you do. Now, here's what I want to end with. If you're an unbeliever, and self-preservation, self-love is kind of the driving force of everything, and you're dead wrong on how to love God, how to love your neighbor, and how to love yourself, how does that change? How does my nature go to where now, as a Christian, I don't always do it because I'm not glorified yet, but I'm at least convinced I most love God and most love others and most love self when I'm being holy. I'm at least convinced of that, even though obviously I'm not glorified yet. I don't do it all the time. How does that switch happen? And that's what I want to talk about next week. It basically comes back to this idea of being born again. How does our nature change? How do our desires change? When Jesus promised the truth will set you what? Free? Oh, how does a person go from slavery to freedom? Well, last week we talked about man's inability. Well, how does a person get ability? How can I can love God now. How does that happen? And that's what I want to talk about next week. Any questions about this? Again, this ties in with our idea of free will because people do what they want to do. That's why they're free. But they're also doing what they want to do. So somehow our want to's got to change. How does that happen? That's what I want to talk about next week. Any other questions or observations? Was there a blank on here I didn't do? I don't know. I get lost. It's good. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, there's some connection being made that I've got to get back to the root. And that's one of the reasons we did the quarter we did last year on the heart. Okay, I can look at my fruit and that can help me get back to what's going on in the root part here. So even in a millisecond, connections are made and I'm bursting out in anger. Now, again, like sitting in a pew, I'm driving down the road, someone cuts me off and go, okay, they cut me off. They could have caused me to wreck. Yeah, I'm going to be angry. Yeah, I'm super angry at you right now. Like, that's not, it's usually just blah. Like, they cut you off and you turn into Hulk, you know. I don't like bad drivers, if you can't tell. But I also lived in California for 4 years, and that's part of it. The idea, again, like you're saying, is that's a great example of, I don't remember logically tracing my thought, but I can look at my outburst and know something happened. At the moment I perceived what happened, I almost immediately exploded in anger. There's something going on there that I need to go work in. Does that make sense? There's some connection being made here that I've got to switch out the plug for something else. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah, 20 seconds before you got angry, you would probably say, I don't want to get angry today. And then that happens, and then you get angry. And I can say in that moment you wanted to get angry, even though removed from it, you didn't want to get angry. And that's the hard part. And we'll get to this later, but that's the part that I use sad, and not in a hopeless sense. Listen, if we're a Christian, there's one day we'll be glorified. But the sad part, when I think about sins that I make, you know, I commit, I burst out at someone, or I'm lazy on this, or whatever sin it is that I'm doing, what is really sad is, man, why do I still want to do these things? Like, I wish I never wanted to do anything sinful ever again. Wouldn't that be great for everyone? So again, what is the hope in that? We'll talk about that. How does it change? All that kind of stuff. We'll get to that starting next week with being born again. Yeah, that's the other thing, is no matter how old you are, it took you that long to get here, be patient. You're not going to change overnight. What I've found works best for me is when someone points out something I've done wrong, is just tell them they don't understand. That works really well. Just, you don't understand. Yeah. No, you're right. It works best if you acknowledge it and start working on it. Absolutely. Anything else?